The time is 8:30. You're listening to WART Wart Radio, which means it's time once again for Demo or Bust 2010. Hello everyone and welcome to Demo or Bust 2010 episode number 6. In this episode we're going to be talking about the Nintendo Entertainment System, also known as the Famicom. And we will be focusing entirely on this for the entire episode. So before we get into any of this, I do want to play an un-Nintendo-related demo. This probably will be the only one. So we'll be back right after this.
Thank you.
was Stargazer by Orb and Andrew Media. The Pyaut ID on this one is 51438, and this is the winner for NVZine 2008. Our friend, the Nintendo, which you probably grew up blowing into their cartridges and smacking on the top of your console trying to get the bloody thing to work. So you open up the Nintendo and there are two primary chips, probably the biggest chips on the board. There's the processor, which is a 6502 ish sort of processor. The actual chip on this is labeled the 2A03. Now, again, this is a 6502, but the sound circuitry is also on the die of the chip. Believe it or not, this chip has an audio out pin, which is pretty cool, especially if you want to make a chiptune player for the Nintendo. All you really need is this one chip, more or less, right? Plus some RAM and these other such things. The other chip is the PPU, or the picture processing unit. The label on this chip is the 2C02. Now, if you crack open your Nintendo cartridge, let's say Super Mario Brothers, you'll find three chips. Two ROM chips, and then a little itsy-bitsy chip, which is the sort of lock-out chip for the sort of protection chip for the Nintendo. And we're going to ignore this protection chip for a while. So these two ROM chips pretty much go to the two main chips. The one on the left, I believe, would be the program ROM. This is looking at the board from the top, where all the components are facing up, and the connector of the cartridge is on the bottom. The one on the left is the actual program ROM of the program, and this is mapped directly into the address space of the 6502. I'll just call it the 6502 and the PPU from now on, instead of the 2A03 and 2C02. So this is mapped directly into the memory map of the 6502. The other chip is not program ROM, it's actually sprite ROM, which is mapped into the address space of the PPU. Now, the program ROM is broken up into two 16 kilobyte chunks, bank 0 and bank 1. In the 6502 RAM, bank 0 is mapped to address C000 to the top of memory, and bank 1 is mapped to address 80. This is in hex, address 8000. The reason for this, it kind of looks kind of funky, but the reason why we map bank 0 into the very top of memory is because if we have a cartridge that only has 116 kilobyte bank of ROM, the reset vectors that tell the 6502 where to actually start, and the IRQ vector telling the 6502 where to interrupt when there's an IRQ, is in the upper part of memory. So this has to, there has to be ROM there in order for the Nintendo itself to start. So the Nintendo, the 6502 memory map has a lot of mirroring, and it looks kind of funky, and this is one way it looks kind of funky. Now, the other ROM chip that is in the cartridge, again, is the character ROM, and this is mapped into the very bottom of the PPU memory map. In two 4 kilobyte chunks. We call these pattern table 0 and pattern table 1. Now, these possibly could be character RAM as well, but I'm going to describe firstly a very basic Nintendo system, just running Mario, because it turns out a lot of the complexities in the Nintendo is put into the cartridge with various mappers and bank switchers and all these things that are present in the cartridge, whereas the Nintendo itself is pretty simple. Now, how the rest of the PPU memory map looks like is this. Well, of course, we have these character ROM banks, and this goes up to address 2000, hex 2000. Then we have name table 0 and attribute table 0. We also have name table 1 and attribute table 1. And then we have these two mirrors of the two name table/attribute tables that I mentioned. called Name Table Attribute Table 2, Name Table Attribute Table 3. Now, how these two superfluous name table slash attribute table banks are mirrored to the prior two name table slash attribute table banks depends on whether the cartridge is mirrored, said to be mirrored vertically or horizontally. I think this was meant for horizontal scrollers versus vertical scrollers. But if it's mapped horizontally, name table 2 gets the 2 bits get mapped to the 0. If that makes sense. And then 3 gets mapped to 1. And then if it's vertical, 2 gets mapped to 1 and 3 gets mapped to 0. And then we have the image palette and the sprite palette. But let's go back a little bit to name tables. I should mention that how things are on the Nintendo screen on the television when you play the Nintendo is you have a background plane that is scrollable by some horizontal amount or some vertical amount, and then you have sprites over that. So you have a background and sprites, pretty much. And the background is made up of two name tables, two 32 by 30 arrays, a two-dimensional array of 8x8 sprites. And so if the cartridge is mirroring horizontally, you can think of the name tables as side-by-side horizontally, so that you wrap horizontally past 64 sprites, and you wrap vertically past 30 sprites. And if it's mirrored vertically, you wrap horizontally by 32 sprites, and you map vertically by 60 sprites, if that makes sense. Now, how the name table actually stores the sprites that are in the name table is pretty straightforward. It's just a linear index into the sprite number of the sprite data that's stored in the character ROM. Now we'll talk a little bit about the sprite data stored in the character ROM in a second. But basically, it's four color sprites in there. So it's 2-bit colored sprites in there. And the Nintendo gets the upper 2 bits because it's 4-bit color altogether. It can show 16 colors in the background plane through the attribute table. And each byte in the attribute table represents a 4x4 sprite chunk. And this chunk has to have the same upper 2 bits. And this chunk is divided into four 2x2 sprite chunks. And so the upper two, the lowest 2 bits in the attribute byte represent the upper left square. The next 2 bits represent the upper right square. The next 2 bits represent the lower left square. And the last 2 bits represent the low right square. How the sprite data is actually stored in the character ROM is with 16 bytes per sprite, and each byte is a horizontal little endian bitmap. And so the first eight bytes is bit zero, this bitmap of bit zero, and then you have the next 8 bytes being bitmap of bit one. And that's a sprite. So let's take a break, and we'll get back and sort of recap what we said and kind of give you a synopsis of what we said before we move further into the Nintendo. That was Harspris, Embered Recollections. I could be saying that wrong. By Morph Cat, and the Piat ID on this is, this is a music disc. The Piat ID on this is 53223. Now, what we just described in the previous segment is the basic architecture of the Nintendo. We have two chips, a processor, and a graphics chip called the Picture Processing Unit. And these chips have their own memory map independent of each other, and two ROMs in the game cartridge devoted to each one. And we also described how sprites are stored in the graphics chip and how they're referenced with name tables and attribute tables to make up the background plane on the screen. Now, I do want to add very briefly, perhaps right now, there is a second bank of memory that the PPU has access to. This is called the Sprite Attribute Table. This is a 256-byte bank of memory that's used to describe where the sprites are over the background plane. But we'll get into that a bit later. All the communication that the processor does, by communication, I mean to the graphics chip and the sound hardware and the controllers and whatnot, is done through a bank of registers that is mapped to address 2000 in the 6502 memory. And in these bank of registers, we have a couple of registers, one of which is called the PPU memory address. This is an 8-bit bank, specifically at address 2006 in hex. And what this does is you supply the VRAM address 2 bytes, because it's a word. It's a 16-bit address. The least significant, the high byte is written first and the low byte is written last. And the next register in the register set is at address 2007. This is the I.O. register. You can write a byte to the PPU memory this way, or you can read a byte to the PPU memory this way. And we talked about the sprite memory. There's a similar sort of style for accessing the sprite memory. We have at address 2003 the sprite memory address, which is only 8-bit because we only have 256 bytes of this particular bank, and the sprite I.O. register at 2004. In addition to those, we also have a third register for the sprite memory called sprite DMA. This is at address 4014. This, you supply, you write a byte to this, and this byte multiplied by 256 equals the source address for a DMA transfer into the sprite memory, and it transfers all 256 bytes after that address into the sprite memory. And so let me briefly go through one by one all the registers that are in this I.O. bank to give you a feel for what the CPU can control and how it controls it. The first register, and this is starting at address 2000 in the CPU memory map, and I'll enumerate these just from now on. And I should also add that when I refer to VRAM, I mean PPU, the PPU memory map. I may have said that before, and I'll most definitely say in the future. So that's what I mean when I say VRAM. I mean the PPU memory map. So the first register in the I.O. bank is the PPU control register, so the first one. Then we have another PPU control register. Then we have the PPU status register, the sprite memory address register, then the sprite I.O. register, the background scroll register, the PPU memory address register, the PPU I.O. register. Then we have all the sound registers, which I won't get into quite now. We'll get into that in a later part. And the sound registers go all the way up to address 4014. Then we have the sprite DMA register again, and after that we have the sound control register. Then we have the joypad number 1 register and joypad number 2 register. And that's about it for I.O. Between the program and the rest of the system. Oh, let's have a look at Super Mario Brothers. Super Mario Brothers is a game with two 16 kilobyte banks of program ROM for the 6502, as well as one bank of character ROM for the PPU. And in bank zero, again, the interrupt vectors are present. So let's examine what the interrupt vectors are. We have three of those. We have an IRQ, an unmaskable interrupt, as well as a reset vector. The reset vector happens to be 8,000 as present in the ROM. This tells the 6502 where to begin. So let's disassemble the ROM from address 8,000, and we can see that the first thing that Super Mario Brothers does is it turns off interrupts. It then loads hexadecimal 40 into register the register at 2,000, which happens to be the PPU control register number 1. And what 40 hex is, the bitmap of this, correlates to turning the interrupt on sprite hits on. Now, the kind of going back to sprites a little bit, the Nintendo has a very special sprite. This is a sprite 0, which can be used as a what's called a hit sprite. What this means is that when the raster, when the scan line encounters a pixel in sprite 0, which is not 0, it generates an interrupt. This generally is used for being able to mark places on the screen where we should change how the background is scrolled. For instance, with Super Mario Brothers, specifically what this is used for, not in this case at the very beginning, because it's used as initialization at the very beginning, but later on in Super Mario Brothers, the hit sprite is actually used for the menu at the top that has your score and all the status for your little Mario character that's running around. And the hit sprite, when the raster reaches that sprite, then we scroll the background name tables, the background plane, to where it would be in just normal gameplay, because you're moving this background plane, because it's a background plane, because it's a 2D scroller, right? But you're not moving the status at the top. So the status at the top is actually in the background plane, but it's not being moved because we're using the sprite hit interrupt as a reference to when to move it and when not to move it. Now, what we're doing here, at the very beginning, I presume, granted I am not a programmer from the 80s or anything like that, and so just by disassembling Super Mario Brothers, I assume what the programmers were doing here was that they were turning on the sprite hit interrupt, which doesn't actually generate an interrupt because they turned off the interrupt mask in the 6502 before doing this. But what it actually does it allows the PPU status register, which is also part of the 6502 register bank that can be read by the 6502. There's a particular bit in here that is set to 1 when the sprite hit occurs, whether we have that interrupt masked or not. So going on, looking at the disassembly of the very beginning of Super Mario Brothers, we see that the program is actually looking at the PPU status register, and it is waiting until it is 1. The hit occurrence flag is the actual flag that this is twice. I don't know why it's doing this twice, but it waits till it's 1, then waits until it's 1 again. Now, I presume, again, this is just my assumption based on looking at this program, is that perhaps that the programmers wanted to bring the Nintendo into a state that was known, like completely known, because when you start the Nintendo, you are unaware of where the raster would be as compared to where your program is. So maybe if your program depends on having a vertical blank interrupt occur at a particular time in initialization, or before a particular time in initialization, it's helpful to know have everything exactly in sync how you assume the Nintendo is. Of course, this is speculation, but this is what I think they're doing. So let's skip all the initialization and let's go into the actual gameplay when you play Super Mario Brothers. What we have is a screen with the menu on top and the actual game field on the bottom. Again, we have the hit sprite just below the menu. And what the main loop of Super Mario Brothers does is it moves the background plane, scrolls it horizontally to zero, waits until we hit the bottom of the menu, scrolls the horizontal by a modulus of where you are in the game map, of a modulus of the size, full size, of the name tables, so that we wrap the horizontal scroll on the name tables as you move forward. Then we wait until a vertical interrupt, and then we scroll it back to zero and do this all over again. Now, when you move forward in the game, what it does is it updates the name tables below your moving window to represent where you are in its own internal map. And it does this by updating the name tables first, then it updates the attribute tables. All the while updating the player information, where you are, where the monsters are, and checking to see if the status of the controllers has changed. Now, all the monsters are done with sprites, and Mario's done with sprites as well. The coins that we have that are fading in and out, it just adjusts the palette for this, for the question mark boxes, where we have this shiny gold that is shining in and out. It just cycles through gold-ish looking colors for the palette, and that's how that's done. Now, we can have 64 sprites above the background plane more or less simultaneously. The attributes for these are stored in, again, the sprite attribute table, which is a 256-byte bank of memory that's accessible by the PPU as well as the 6502 through the DMA register as well as the sprite address and sprite data registers. The sprite information looks like this. We have we have 4 bytes per sprite, the first byte being the Y coordinate of where the sprite is, the second byte being the tile index. Third sprite is a bitmap of flags indicating whether this sprite is flipped vertically, flipped horizontally, or whether this sprite has priority over the background. Now, what priority over the background means is, well, there's a special color in the Nintendo, color zero. This color is used for transparency. If the sprite color is transparent, we default, if it has a sprite, if the priority is over the background, we default to drawing the background. Now, if the priority is one being behind the background, and the background color is not zero, we default to the background color. And if they both happen to be zero, there is a background register color in the register bank, and we default to that color. Now, the fourth byte for each sprite indicates the X coordinate. Now I should mention that we can have 8x8 sprites, but we can also have 8x16 pixel sprites. This is used in games like Castlevania, for instance. And the only real difference between these, aside from the size of the sprite, is the sprite tile index number no longer is a linear index into the character ROM of where the sprite is, but rather this value's most significant bit is assumed to be the least significant bit, and the least significant bit is ignored, if that makes sense. So then the sprite data is stored in 8x8 sprites linearly, being the top part of the 8x16 sprite and the bottom part of the 8x16 sprite. The advantage of this, of course, being now we can have a screen that appears to have 128 8x8 sprites, but in reality it's 64 8x16 sprites. Only 8 sprites per scan line can be displayed, which is one exception on the amount of sprites that can be on the screen at any time. You can see an artifact of this when you're playing and there's a bunch of Goombas next to you, or some sort of enemy next to you, or monster next to you. And you and all the monsters kind of blink a lot. I don't know if you've seen this, but play the Nintendo and you'll probably see this. When you have a bunch of things there together, this is because you're exceeding the maximum number of sprites that can be on the scan line at one time. There are a lot of emulators that ignore this, but you'll probably see it on a real Nintendo. Now, both the backgrounds and the sprites have two palettes, and these palettes are in the PPU memory map. Again, each one is an array of 16 byte entries, and they're actually 6-bit entries, but the 6th and 7th bit of each byte is ignored. These color entries in the palette don't actually hold any RGB values or anything like this, but rather it is a bitmap of the luminance as well as the chroma blue and chroma red of the pixel, or rather of the palette entry. And there are 2 bits associated with each one. So we have a choice from a supposed palette of 64 colors, where if the upper luma bits are 1, the colors are nearly white, whereas if it's 0, the colors have no luminance to them. They're very saturated, if that makes sense. On the chroma spectrum of this bitmap, on low values, we have a very low saturation, so we have a grayscale, more or less. And then on high values, I haven't really figured this out myself, but on high values, we have all black. Not exactly sure why we have all black on high values, but that's where we get black from. And so the rest of the spectrum almost just looks like a pure chroma spectrum where we have a rainbow. You, of course, don't have to figure any of this out. You can probably find the RGB values of the Nintendo color map just by looking it up on Google if you want to put this into your emulator or figure out what colors to choose for your game or something like that. And so I think we've talked enough about video for the moment. I may get back to it, but now I'm going to focus on the audio hardware in the Nintendo. Thank you. That was a intro called Stars by Chris Covell. The Piat ID on this is 15216. Now, the sound hardware, which is, again, on the actual die of the 2A03, consists of four internal channels, more or less. We have two square wave channels, we have one triangle wave channel, and we have a noise generation channel. In addition to this, we can also do delta code modulation samples out of the Nintendo audio hardware as well. But for the moment, let me focus on the square wave and triangle wave channels. All these channels, the four, including the sample channel, we'll call this channel 5, mind you, can be either muted or unmuted by a register 4000, the register in address 4015 of the 6502 memory map. This is a 5-bit number, 0 being mute, 1 being unmute. Each channel of the each square wave channel, the triangle channel, the noise channel, each of these have a 4 bytes in the register bank associated with them to control them, and they're all controlled in the exact same way. The 4 bytes for square wave for the first square wave channel is mapped to address 4000. The second square wave channel is mapped to address 4004. The triangle channel is mapped to 4008. And lastly, the noise channel is mapped to 4000C. Now, these, for all intents and purposes, represent the same synth. The only difference between the square wave, the triangle, and the noise wave is we're dealing with a different waveform, but the 4 bytes work the same way for every channel. The first byte controlling each channel is called the control register, called control register number 1. The bits in these include a duty cycle. We have 2 bits representing a duty cycle from 25% to 87%, which is used to simulate envelopes. Well, not to simulate, to have a primitive envelope or primitive frequency shift. The next bit is a hold note flag, which can be used to hold the duty cycle of the frequency shifts or continue the duty cycle of the frequency shift or the envelope. Then we have the next bit, which represents a envelope that is controlled by the cycle or an envelope that is fixed. And then we have the playback rate, which, if you wanted to, could be used to control the total duration of the duty cycle. There are 4 bits associated with this. Now, the next byte is the control register number 2, which is a bitmap again. The very first bit, the most significant bit, that's the order in which I'm describing these, from most significant bit to least significant bit, represents is 0 if the frequency does not sweep over time. It is 1 if it does sweep over time. And then we have 3 bits associated with the frequency sweep speed. Then we have 1 bit associated with whether it shifts from low to high or high to low. And then we have 3 bits associated with the frequency range in which this sweeps. Then the next byte is the frequency value. The total frequency value is 11 bits, but the lower 8 bits is mapped into this particular byte. The upper 8 is mapped into the next byte, the last byte controlling each channel. In the first 3, the least 3 significant bits in this byte are mapped to the most significant bits in the frequency value register. And the rest of the bits in this register is an indication of the active time. This gets cut off after this time is expired, instead of having an envelope that goes down in volume. Now, I will be honest with you, my experience with programming the audio hardware is not as solid as I would like it to be. I've just written an emulator for this, but you probably should find your closest chiptune person and ask them about any questions that you may have with the audio hardware, because I'm going to go into the depth that I know about the hardware in this episode. I'm not going to go any further. The sample channel, the last channel that we're going to talk about, has a similar sort of style of control. We have duty cycles again for the first control register. We have whether this frequency will be held or not. We have whether this envelope will remain fixed or decay over time. And we also have a playback rate. The next byte for the sample control is just the volume. This is an 8-byte value, controlling the volume of the sample. The byte after that is the address register. This register represents the upper 8 bits in a 16 bits pointer to where the audio is stored. After that, we have the length register. This is 8 bits that describes the size of the sample. Now, every time you write to the control register of the sample channel, this triggers the playing of a sample. And so I'm thinking that's about all I'm going to talk about with sound, because I'm not entirely comfortable with the sound aspect of the Nintendo. But if you write, I have a little bit of advice for you. If you write an emulator, download Nofrendo, and the sound core for the APU is what they call it, the audio processing unit, is really simple to use. Basically, it's a function that you call when you want to write to any of these registers, and then you periodically call a function that updates a sample, a buffer with what audio is coming out of the speaker. The core of Nofrendo can also be found in the Nintendo sound format player called NoseFart. Now, the Nintendo sound format is kind of a hack of the program ROM data to completely get rid of all the game information and all the graphics information, just have it being played on a APU/processor emulation. The program NoseFart, for instance, does this. So people who make Nintendo sound format files either do this with a tracker, and this tracker writes a program that this emulator, this half Nintendo implemented emulator, runs, and then it runs some sort of internal, through some sort of internal format that this tracker uses for the program that it has encapsulated into the NSF file. Or people extract the sound information from games, like Mega Man, for instance. How the sound is produced is it's produced via the interrupts, via the vertical interrupts of the game. We have a address that we call to set up a particular song that we want to play with the accumulator in the 6502, being the soundtrack that we want to play. Once that's done, the vertical interrupt periodically calls another address to update the sound registers in the APU to actually generate the sound. And this is how the music's done in Mega Man, for instance, Mega Man 1. And it's similar for a lot of other games. So what people have done is they've found out where the code that's specifically meant for sound is, and they've encapsulated it in Nintendo sound format files. This would probably be useful to you as a Nintendo programmer, because if you're generating an NSF file with a tracker, it's stored as a program. You need to find the initialization routine. You can call this in your game program, and then you need to periodically call a function to update the sound registers. And that way, perhaps you don't have to program these registers directly. You can use a more intuitive way of generating sounds, like with a tracker. Now, let's go back and talk about the Nintendo generally. We've just described a basic Nintendo system that is playing a cartridge with a ROM for the 6502 and a ROM for the PPU. This is all well and good, but you are limited in the amount of characters you can have on the screen, as well as the size of the program. And over time, people have overcome these limitations by putting into the cartridge things that are called mappers or bank switchers. And what these are chips that look at the address bus. And when the address bus of the program ROM gets accessed at key points, this either triggers the bank switch of the program ROM or the bank switch of the character ROM or other things to extend the amount of storage that can be put into a cartridge. Modifications to the cartridges also include things like character RAM. For instance, where we don't have character ROM, and then it's the program ROM's responsibility to initialize the character RAM with characters. Super Mario Brothers 2 does this, for instance. And for a lot of the animated characters, like the cherries that swing back and forth, it's not accessing the name table of the background where these cherries are stored on the screen, but rather it's accessing the actual sprite data and overwriting this with another frame. That way you don't have to keep track of where cherries are on the screen. You can just overwrite the source of how cherries get drawn. Another game that uses this, for instance, is again, Mega Man 1. Now, the most common mapper is mapper number 1, which is a mapper that is made by Nintendo Corporation. And this is a program ROM bank switcher as well as a character RAM bank switcher. So if you write an emulator, first you probably should write a base system, and then probably you should write emulation for mapper number 1. Now, going back to the base system again, how do we read controller information? Well, we read this through 6502, a couple of registers in the register bank in the 6502 memory. The addresses of these two is 4016 as well as 4017. 4016 representing controller number 1 and 4017 representing controller number 2. Now, how you access this is you write 1 to register 4016. Or register 4017, depending on what control you're accessing. What this does is, well, inside the controller, there is a shift register that shifts out 8 bits, each bit associated with the button that's being pressed. If you write 1, this resets the shift register. then you can read sequentially, strobing out each bit of the shift register. The first read is A, then B, start, select, up, down, left, right. This is how the joysticks work. Now, I'm not going to talk about the zapper, unfortunately, because I have no experience with using the zapper. But let's now talk about the quirks of the Nintendo. The sprite memory address register, as well as the PPU address memory register, is physically the same latch. So that if you write to the sprite memory address register, it's exactly like writing to the PPU memory register, and vice versa. If you write to the sprite memory address register, it clears it resets what byte is being written to the PPU memory register, so that the byte that you just wrote happens to be the lower byte, if that makes sense. Another quirk is, generally you're not supposed to write to any of the PPU memory while the display is being drawn. This is something that you reserve for the vertical blank. This is because internally the PPU uses the registers, its registers, as a scratch pad for actually drawing the image. The advantage of this, however, is that it's a little bit of a hack, but you can write to these registers while the raster is being drawn. You can do things like squeeze vertically the image size. I've seen this done in demos, for instance, for having objects that look like texture maps that are being rotated along the x-axis. This is done by squeezing the entire display vertically to have it simulate how the texture map would look like as the surface becomes perpendicular to the screen. Another thing you can do is you can, if you're very good at keeping track of time, you can write the horizontal scroll of the background plane while it's being drawn to create parallax effects and things like this. Now, another tip for emulator writers, when you write a Nintendo emulator, chances are your bottleneck is going to be PPU emulation. What you want to do is not emulate three clock cycles of the processor and then emulate one pixel of the PPU, because the PPU draws a pixel per every three clock cycles of the processor. Going back and forth like this will kill your cache coherency and will make your emulator dog slow. What you want to do is emulate the amount of cycles for an entire frame, because most of the communication between the PPU and the CPU is one way. The only communication you're getting back from the PPU is the hit flag interrupt, which you can emulate in a separately within this portion of the emulator. Then you want to next emulate a full frame of the PPU, and this will speed things up considerably. Another tip is to, instead of evaluating a background pixel and then evaluating a sprite pixel for every pixel, evaluate all the background pixels to, again, increase locality of your program flow. Then after that, evaluate all the sprite pixels, and then go through some sort of code to decide which pixel gets drawn. this will also speed things up considerably. You know, I think that's going to be it for this episode. We're getting a little bit long on time, and I hope that this helped you in any way or you found it interesting. I hope this wasn't too boring. Unfortunately, there is so much information to divulge with the Nintendo. We haven't even scratched the surface. It's a very, very interesting little piece of hardware, and writing an emulator is probably one of the funnest things you can do. So thanks for listening. We're going to close with not a Nintendo song, unfortunately, but this is a song by the Black Lotus that I am in love with for whatever reason. I'm totally going to marry it. Like, I don't know why I like this song so much, but I really do. So thank you much, and we will see you next week. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting.